Hello and welcome, welcome, welcome to the 67th PEM podcast, the Psychic Eye Mystery Podcast. I'm your host, Victoria Laurie, along with my beautiful, fabulous co-host, my sister, Sandy, who always makes that face when I say that she's beautiful, because she is, and she just doesn't like to admit it. Anyway, we are coming at you for the 67th time. I went to the grocery store today, Sans, and was wearing this, and this gentleman steps in front of me. I had like my red scarf on and everything. And he goes, "You look like Christmas."
Oh my God. Well, you do look really lovely in red. I'm glad you've discovered that.
Thank
that color...
you, sir.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad that color works on you. Yeah.
"You look like Christmas."
Oh, thank you.
Hey.
Is it my fat belly?
Oh,
what's
look,
happening?
I need to get something in four aisles over there.
Yeah.
No, he's a sweet old man, sweet old guy. But I just found his reaction, you know, like the proclamation.
Yes.
You know,
"You look like Christmas."
Adorable.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. All right. Well, you know, on this rainy, gross day here in Michigan, I'm glad I look like a little bit like Christmas, you know. Hopefully it brightened his day a little bit, but I don't know. Anyway, okay, so this week, 3 days ago, or as I'm thinking, 2 days ago, my sister and I were talking yesterday.
Yes.
And she's like, "Well, what time do you want to record tomorrow?" I'm like, "Tomorrow is Thursday," because we'd planned on recording on Friday. And she goes, "No, today's Thursday." I'm like, "Sandy, come on, look at your calendar."
And I'm like this. I know it's Thursday because I'm going.
She's like, "Look at your phone." I'm like, "No, it's Wednesday." Oh my God. I don't know what happened this week. Like, just complete blank. It just flew. I think it's the Thanksgiving weekend, you know, kind of thing that like.
Hangover.
Yeah. Thursday felt like Saturday. Friday felt like Sunday. And then we were doing a repeat of Saturday and Sunday. Somewhere in there, my brain got lost, which is not hard. Anyway, so this past Tuesday, my 40th book.
Yeah.
40th book, I think. Coaching Fire. Came out, and I love this cover so much. It's so dynamic. It's like screaming, like, "Pick me up," but with mittens, with oven gloves. Yeah, this will be maybe the last book in this series.
For a while.
There's so much on the plate. There's just so much writing to do over the course of the next 2 years that I'm not sure that I'll be able to kick another one out of these in this series anytime soon. So get you some while you can. So I took a lot from the history and a subject matter expert on the Tyler Texas Rose Festival. Who happens to be the director and the costume designer of that festival from like now on. And he is freaking genius. And he gave me all the inside scoop, and like, it was just wonderful. It was such a fascinating look into an event that I had never heard of, but that apparently is a huge deal. So especially in Tyler, Texas, and in the Rose Bowl. So anyway, it's two crimes. Maybe they have something to do with each other. Maybe they don't, are interwoven in this mystery where Kat and Gilly are doing their darndest to try and solve it. And Shepard, of course, lends his hands.
The question that gets asked in book four comes to a conclusion in book
five. Well, it's not necessarily asked as it is implied. So Kat discovers in Shepard's blazer, a ring box, and in it is an engagement ring. So before she sets off for Europe at the end of book four, she knows that he plans on asking her to marry him. So yeah, so that all gets wound up in this last book. So pick it up wherever books are sold. And anecdote this week, I'm going to do it short because I know we're kind of pressed for time a little bit. Was doing a reading not too long ago and was reading for a woman whose father came in, and he was such an animated guy, and he was born in Pakistan and moved here. So his family, she was first generation. And he kept saluting me. So that's my symbol for military. Turns out he had served in the military over there. And then he kept waving this red, white, and green, I think, flag in my face. And I said, was he super patriotic? And she's like, well, you know, he loved living in America, but, you know, home was home. And I'm like, no, there's something more with this flag. So I told her, I said, you know, he keeps waving the flag of what I assume is his homeland, Pakistani flag, in my face. And she's like, I have his flag. That was his flag. And she has it. So I went and looked up the Pakistani flag, and it doesn't look like the colors that I saw. And I'm like, well, that's weird. And then I did a little bit more research and discovered that that's the new flag.
Ah.
Old flag had the other colors that I was being shown. So
again, speaking to the fact that she has that flag, that's what he was referring
yes,
to.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. She has the original older flag.
Yeah.
Not the newer flag. So it was kind of, it's always interesting for me to get in someone who's from another country and has a whole different experience that, you know, is just completely outside of the realm of my, you know, knowledge or experience. And I love it when they're so animated and they come in with a ton of energy and they just are like really just trying really hard to get me to say certain things. So he was lovely. And there was a lot there to kind of confirm and prove that, you know, consciousness survives. So if you all want a similar experience, you can go to victorialaurie.com, sign up for a reading with me. Or since I look like Christmas, I'm going to self-promote and say, if you would like to get a gift certificate for a loved one of yours to reconnect with a loved one of theirs, then you can head over to victorialaurie.com, click on the schedule a psychic reading, go down to the bottom and click on the gift certificate option. So get you some. The other thing that I want to briefly quickly mention is that I am doing my annual, it's usually biannual, but annual predictions for 2024. I've started with the U.S. economy. That's located on my Patreon page. Go to Patreon, look for Victoria Laurie. It'll take you right to that. If you're a paid subscriber, only $2.50 per month. What a bargain. You can read all of my coming predictions, and I'm going to cover a ton of topics. It's going to take me about 10 days to weed my way through this. So the economy, the U.S. economy, 2024, really through 2026, because it's on a trend, is what I talk in length about. So there's some really good, great, exciting stuff there. I'll cover politics. I will cover weather and natural disasters. There's a big one, I think, that's headed not our way, but a big one in the world coming. I wouldn't go to Italy. Let me just put that out there. I especially wouldn't go near Mount Vesuvius anytime soon. I'm just putting that out there.
Eat pasta at home.
Yes, exactly. The taste of Italy in your kitchen at home.
Olive Garden, one or the other.
Yeah, I know. I'll be going into that. I'll be going into medical technologies that I feel are making advancements. I'll be going into trends. I mean, there's just a whole huge gamut of stuff that I cover. It's a lot of material. So if you'd like to read about it, head over to my Patreon page, become a patron, a subscriber, and you'll get the inside scoop. Okay. All right. Over to you, Sands.
Okay. So this week's case is about a woman named Joan Riche who disappeared in 1961. And I want to say that I came across this case because a fan suggested it. And for the life of me, I don't know what fan it was. So to whomever that
was. We have let you down. We are so sorry. We have dropped the ball on that.
I did. And I apologize, but please know read a suggestion and took it to heart and have developed this case around that. So thank you to the fan that has suggested this. So Joan Carolyn Bard Riche was a 31-year-old mother of two and a wife to a husband, Martin, and she disappeared from her home in Lincoln, Massachusetts on October 24th, 1961. To date, the circumstances surrounding her disappearance and what happened to Joan remains a mystery. She was born on May 12th in 1930 in Brooklyn, New York, to Harold and Josephine Bard, and at the age of 8, moved with her family to Mountain Lakes, New Jersey. In February of 1939, while Joan was visiting relatives in Brooklyn, her home caught fire and her parents perished in what was later described as a suspicious fire, although an investigation was ultimately inconclusive and the local fire chief deemed the tragedy accidental. Shortly thereafter, Joan was adopted by her mother's sister and her husband, from which she took the couple's last name, Natress. Apparently, Joan had a difficult time living with her new family, as she purportedly told an acquaintance that she had been sexually abused as a child. After graduating in 1952 from Wilson College in Schaumburg, Pennsylvania, with a degree in English literature, Joan pursued a career in publishing that included working as an editorial assistant at Harcourt, Brace & World, and later at Thomas Y. Crowell & Company. The 5'7", 120-pound Joan with blue eyes and short, dark brown hair caught the eye of publishing executive Martin Riesch. Shortly after exchanging I do's, she left her job in 1956, and the couple moved to Ridgefield, Connecticut. Their daughter Lillian was born in 1957 and David in 1959. In April of 61, the family moved to Lincoln, Massachusetts, which is a Tony suburb, so Martin could take a job at the Fitchburg Paper Company. 6 months later, on the morning of October 24, 1961, Martin left their house on Old Bedford Road for an 8 a.m. flight to New York with plans to stay overnight in Manhattan. Following breakfast, Joan took her son David across the street to her neighbor's house, Barker, so she could drive her daughter Lillian in the family's blue 1951 Chevy to a dentist appointment in Bedford and then stop by a nearby department store. Once home around 11:15 a.m., Joan changed into a sweater, a blouse, a charcoal-colored wool skirt, and blue sneakers with white piping. She made lunch for her kids and put David into his room for his afternoon nap, which almost always lasted until about 2 o'clock. At 1, Barker brought her son Douglas, also age 4, over to play with Lillian. And then at 2 o'clock, Joan brought Lillian and Douglas back to the Barkers to play on the swing set and told the kids she'd be back later. At around 2:15, Barbara briefly saw Joan wearing what she thought was a trench coat over her clothing, moving quickly up her driveway, carrying something red with outstretched arms from her car towards the garage. At the time, she assumed Joan was chasing her son David, and it was later the last confirmed sighting of Joan Riesch.
Hold on, just she was holding something red with outstretched arms.
Yeah, but you have to understand that the neighbor was across the street. So looking right up briefly, she kind of probably witnessed something with her arms outstretched.
Okay.
Yeah. So
that sounds weird to me, right?
It is weird, but also consider it's the last time that anyone can confirm seeing her. So the details are probably this is what I saw. And maybe lost in translation. Yeah.
A little fuzzy.
Yeah. Or a little less detailed than if it was caught on camera. At 3:40, believing that Joan was home, Barbara brought Lillian back to her house so that Barbara could take her own children shopping. And upon returning home at around 4:15, Lillian came back to the Barker's house and told Barbara, "Mommy has gone and the kitchen is covered in red paint."
Isn't it interesting that in the 1960s, it's okay, little four-year-old, run along home, off the car goes, right?
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's let me clutch your hand, approach the stairs, knock on the door, hand you physically to your mother, and the fact that the kids are swinging in the backyard kind of unsupervised too, how liberating were the 60s, doesn't happen anymore.
The metal contraption that they called a swing set back in the 60s, right?
I know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. More than one of us got hurt on those.
Yes. So Barbara ran to the Riesch's house, and after finding a bloody kitchen floor and David upstairs unattended, crying in his crib, and no sign of Joan, Barbara called the police around 4:30. Sergeant Mike McHugh of the Lincoln Police Department arrived at the Riesch's house within 5 minutes, and in the kitchen, he found bloody smears on the walls, the floor, and a telephone, as well as an overturned table. The handset on the wall-mounted telephone had been ripped loose and thrown into a wastebasket, which was in the middle of the floor instead of in its usual place under the sink. Also in the wastebasket was an empty liquor bottle, which was later confirmed to have been consumed by the Riesch's the night before, and some empty beer bottles, but where these beer bottles came from, it is not known. The telephone directory was open to the page where emergency numbers were typically noted, but that page was blank. Three unidentified bloody fingerprints were discovered along with a roll of paper towels on the floor. One had been used to wipe up some blood, possibly off of a hand. A coverall and a pair of underpants belonging to David were on the floor, and both were bloodied as well, possibly from an attempt to clean up the blood. The coverall also appeared to have been pressed into the floor as if a heavy weight, such as a body, had been laying on them for some time. Police later said that while the bloodstains in the kitchen might have resulted from a struggle, they seemed more consistent with someone staggering around and trying to support themselves following an injury. Concerned that Joan might have committed suicide, Sergeant McHugh searched the house for her body. And while he did not find a body, additional blood evidence was found in and around the home. Blood was found outside as well as inside, including an 1/8 inch wide drop that was on the first step of the stairway, and two more of similar size were found at the top of the stairs.
So an 1/8 inch is like that big, yeah. Right? It's a tiny drop.
Yeah. Okay. So there was also 8 in the master bedroom and 1 near a window in the children's bedroom. Another trail of blood led out of the kitchen into the driveway and ended at Joan's car, which was stained in 3 places: the right rear fender, the left side of the hood near the windshield, and at the very center of the trunk. Police were not able to identify whose bloody hand and palm prints they belonged to, as Joan's fingerprints were not on file. Oddly, the police did not discover any bloody footprints in and around the crime scene. It could not be determined where the bleeding might have started: upstairs, in the kitchen, or in the driveway. All possibilities supported the evidence. Also open was the question of whether Joan had left under her own power or had been accompanied or even carried, perhaps involuntarily, or perhaps she may have gotten into another car. The department called local hospitals and asked to be notified if a woman matching Joan's description showed up or already had been admitted. After learning that Martin was in New York on business, the Mass State Police called him there to inform him that of the family emergency, and he changed his plans and caught the next flight home back to Boston. After processing the scene, police also considered additional evidence. The blood found at the crime scene was type O, which was Joan's blood type. State police determined that the amount of blood at the scene, which was about a pint, suggested a severe but not life-threatening injury. The trench coat that Joan had worn earlier that morning while running errands was still in the house, but a plain cloth coat was missing. Her pocketbook was found in the house containing less than $10, which is about $100 in today's terms. 4 letters delivered earlier that day to the mailbox at the foot of the driveway had not yet been brought in. Both the mail and milk delivery men reported that they had made their deliveries while Joan was out that morning with Lillian and did not observe anything out of the ordinary. And then shortly after Joan had arrived home at 11:15 that morning, a delivery driver for a dry cleaner came to the house to pick up several of Martin's suits. He entered the house to do so and did not recall anything out of the ordinary about Joan or the house. Police took a statement from Virginia Keene, the daughter of the Reaches' next-door neighbor, who reported that after she got off her school bus, she recalled that as she neared her home, that an unfamiliar car, possibly a GM 1954 or 1955 model sedan, was dirty and two-toned in blue and gray, was parked in the Reaches' driveway around 3:30. 5 minutes later, another local resident who lived on a nearby street said that they stopped while driving up Old Bedford Road to let a car back out of the Reaches' driveway. Police also collected reports about other sightings of the vehicle that Virginia Keene had reported spotting in the Reaches' driveway. The Reaches' regular milkman stated that he had seen it there when he had made his morning delivery 5 days earlier. Another neighborhood resident told investigators that she had seen a blue two-tone car parked on Sunnyside Lane, a street that intersected Route 2A near Old Bedford Road at about 4:15 in the afternoon.
Drive Route 2A. I know exactly where that is.
She saw a man get out, cut some branches from nearby woods, and put them in his vehicle. Another witness said that he saw a light blue 1959 Ford sedan parked along Sunnyside Road at about 2:45 in the afternoon. Police claim that Virginia saw an unmarked police car and that the witnesses are wrong about their timeline of when they may have seen this vehicle in question. The police claim the car was in the Reaches' driveway later in the day, not around 3 in the afternoon, so Virginia's statement has been disputed over the years. There were some possible sightings. In canvassing the neighborhood, police found several other residents who reported possible sightings of Joan after Barbara Barker had last seen her. At 2:45 in the afternoon, a woman wearing clothing similar to what Joan had last been seen wearing, along with a kerchief over her head, tied around her chin, was seen walking along the north side of Route 2A, west of its junction with Old Bedford Road, headed toward Concord. She appeared to be wandering, hunched over as if she were cold, and appeared very untidy. A similar dressed woman with blood running down her legs was seen walking north on Route 128 in the median strip in Waltham between 315 and 330, just north of Winter Street. She too seemed disoriented and appeared to be cradling something in her stomach. A third sighting, reportedly around 4:30 in the afternoon, had the woman walking south along 128 near Trapello Road. The theories of what may have happened to Joan. She staged the crime scene and disappeared voluntarily to escape an unhappy life. She was a regular at the public library and had checked out 25 books over the summer of 1961, with many of which were on topics like murder and missing persons cases. Martin did tell police that Joan enjoyed mystery novels. One book in particular had shocking similarities to Joan's own case. It described how a woman had left behind blood smears and a bloody towel before she went missing. Robert Foster, a purchasing agent for the National Park Service, had been in the Lincoln area meeting with various homeowners about the development of the Minuteman National Historic Park. Some of the women he talked to had felt that he had overstayed his welcome, and records show that he had visited the Reisch's residence on September 25th, a month before Joan disappeared. State police were able to verify Foster's alibi on the day in question. He had actually been with a supervisor and a civil engineer around the time of Joan's disappearance. Another theory is that Joan met an accidental end after becoming disoriented and fell into a pit along Route 128 construction site, where she might not have been able to get herself out of the situation and end up being buried when the road was finished. Another idea was that Joan may have tried to perform an in-home abortion in the kitchen, which could explain the possible sighting of Joan walking dazed and disoriented by her neighbor with blood running down her legs. And then Martin believed that his wife was still alive and that she may have had some sort of manic or psychological breakdown, and in turn developed some sort of amnesia, which may have caused her not to know who she was or how to get back home. Rewards for information that would close the case were offered by the state police, the town of Lincoln, and the Boston Record American newspaper, yet no meaningful leads were developed after the initial investigation. Bodies found in the region in years later proved not to be Joan Reisch. Martin continued to live in the same house and raise his two children. He never had his wife declared legally dead. And in 1975, the National Park Service, in developing the area for the park, purchased the Reisch's home along with other properties in their neighborhood and moved the Reisch's home to Lexington. Martin moved to another house nearby. He died in 2009 at the age of 79, never knowing what became of his beloved wife. My sources for this story include The Disappearance of Joan Reisch in Wikipedia, The Crime Wire, Joan Reisch, Mystery of Missing Housewife Never Solved by Jade Hassenplug, 10/17/23. And I did look at the Charlie Project because that has a listing of missing people. And interestingly enough, they had a very different birth date for Joan. They say it was August 4th, 1931, which makes her 30 when she disappeared, and that her parents actually died in 1940, not 1939. So whatever you want to take from it. So what do you think happened?
Schmeckards. You know, from the beginning, when I was reading this, there just didn't seem to be nefarious energy attached to her disappearance. It felt very fake. The whole thing just feels really, really fake to me. So I don't think she was taken, abducted, assaulted by anyone. I think she staged her own disappearance. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think there's just too many sort of perfect details that would have made it easy for her to leave at that moment. Her husband's out of town, is planning to spend the night in New York. The right. Second being that she's dropped off her daughter across the street, appears to still be very attentive with everything at home. The third being there are paper towels on the floor, and you know, there's some smearing going on, and the garbage has been pulled out from underneath the sink where the handset has been thrown into the, like, it's just a little too contrived. The table that was turned over is a tiny table, and it's turned over at the exit of the kitchen into the hallway, right? So if it's turned over, why is it not kicked aside? Because blood goes upstairs and then comes back down. So whoever kicked it over and then was leaping back and forth over it. Yeah. Like, it just, no, it, none of it feels to me like there was a third party involved at all. I really think this poor woman was just really dissatisfied with her life and wanted to leave it. If she was sexually assaulted, and I always tend to believe women, assaults at a young age of that nature typically trigger PTSD, which is a leading cause of depression. In 1961, right? Mm-hmm. That this happened. Mm-hmm. You didn't really have any depressants. You didn't have any of the psychological tools that we have now to help deal with PTSD or depression or bipolar anxiety or any of that stuff. You know, like it was like if you acted too crazy, you got shock therapy or a lobotomy and they called it a day.
Right.
So, and you know, depressed people 100% can act all happy. I did it for over 45 years. So that's not hard. It's not hard to fake it. So I really just don't think that someone else was involved in her disappearance. I think she left. And I have a feeling Martin felt that she left, which is why he never had her legally declared death and continued to live in that house.
I think that, that makes sense to me. Yeah.
Right. So like if she had been murdered, you know, if he truly believed she'd been murdered or abducted from the home, I doubt he would have stayed there. You know, the scene of, you know, blood and violence and, you know, why would he subject his kids to that too? You know, he would have probably wanted a fresh start. So I have a feeling he knew more about her mental state than he let on. And suspected that she had just been like, I'm out of here. So the mystery novels.
Yeah.
A little more than that there. But
yeah. Well, I always find it, I don't think I can ever relate to, and this is not a judgment, I just don't think I can relate to what.
Oh, the dog and the bird are going at each other. So
excellent.
I threw a little water. Should have split it up.
That's effective.
I know. It's like, I can't really get up in the middle of the podcast to go separate the two. So just throw a little water at them and they're opposite ends. So or birds were hurt in the filming of this podcast. Trust me.
No, I was trying to suggest that I personally can't relate to a mother abandoning her children, but that's not a judgment. That's just me not being able to kind of comprehend that idea. But it could also be, like you say,
PTSD.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. What day is it? PTSD. And it's Thursday. It could be PTSD, and that, you know, that creates a disassociation potentially, and maybe she is capable of walking away. So
I think when you are in a state of depression, you're just unable to form emotional bonds to anybody or anything. And knowing that dad was their neighbor across the street made probably leaving an easier decision.
Yeah. What about the sightings? What do you think those were about?
I think it's bull. Okay. I think people were just, you know, anxious to kind of, I mean, first of all, you see a woman who's out of it with blood leaking down her legs on a well-traveled road, right? On the side, disoriented, looking like she was in pain. She's clutching something to her stomach, and you don't stop and you don't report it to anybody. Really? In 1961, which is like when everybody was up in everybody else's business and getting involved with everything and, you know, neighbors, you know, friendly neighborhood, blah, 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 blah. Like that doesn't read at all to me like that was true. Like this guy, whoever had the sighting remembers that after Joan goes missing and is like, well, I actually saw, you know, no, I don't buy that at all. I think that's one of those things where in 1961, if you saw something like that, you'd pull over and ask, are you okay? Do you need to go to the hospital? Right. The car in the driveway, the two-tone car that was dirty, that was spotted by Virginia, the neighbor, the police ruled that out as having been an unmarked vehicle. Absolutely could have been the detective who was first on the scene. And this little girl likely got confused as to the time. I'm kind of chuckling a little bit about the neighbor who had to stop to allow a car to come out of the Rishi's driveway. Do you remember any cars from in the neighborhood that came out of a specific driveway? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's such a random thing.
Yeah.
You know, that you would A, remember the make and model of the car, what time of day it was, and what driveway it was from.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just weird that mm-hmm. you would remember those specific details. Now, if it was a next door neighborhood or next door neighbor, fine. But this was someone in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So I'm not buying any of the eyewitness testimony. I just think it's baloney. I don't know if she had help, if she found someone to assist her with her disappearance. My thinking is she probably did. She probably knew someone who knows something, but I don't think that there was anything nefarious involved. It just doesn't, there's just no energy around that that says, you know, she was murdered, she was abducted, she was taken against her will, she was bludgeoned, bruised, stabbed, nothing. There's no there there. So okay. I think she left of her own making. That's my theory.
And do you have a sense if she lived a long time or where she ended up?
You know, honestly, she might even still be alive because there's a sense of continuance with her energy.
Mm-hmm.
When people cross, there's a feeling of like dead stop here. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how I can tell when someone's met an untimely end, because their energy feels like it just stops. It comes to a stop. And hers, there's this long trail after it. So for me, either she's still alive or she died recently.
Okay.
So it just goes on, moves on. So I think she left the area, probably headed west because there's no more east to go. So probably headed west and started a new life for herself.
Well, if she were still alive, she'd be somewhere between 92 and 93 years of age. So mm-hmm. it's not implausible
we know plenty of people who are in their 90s.
Yes.
We're related to a couple. So if she died, I think she died fairly recently.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thank you for your take on that. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for your write-up.
Yeah. Did you want to fill the audience in on the last time we presented, you were going to share a personal serial killer story?
Man, that is a rabbit hole that I went down that just blew my freaking mind. So I'm still writing it up. I'm still putting the pieces together, but for me, it put in place several very key pieces of the Oakland County serial child killer mystery into place. There is an unknown suspect out there. There are theories that specifically five individuals were involved in that. And they're like, yeah, it's really probably this group that had a hand in those four murders, but there's an elusive different, it's either four, one, two, three, four.
It's four, five, four known.
Five. There's five known, one unknown.
Oh, okay.
There's a hair that links the last victim and the first victim. And I believe I encountered that unknown guy in our neighborhood.
Okay. So eventually we will be presenting this case.
You know, it's one of those things. It's really, you know, I was telling Sandy, I said, you know, there's only so long I can look at this because it was such a trauma for me. And it still brings up a lot of trauma for me. It's still really, really upsetting and unsettling. And when you dive into just even excusing my own experience mm-hmm. in that whole deal, what was done to those kids, what I know was done to those kids, is just something I can't take in large quantities. I have to kind of piecemeal it out. So I'm working on it. I'm hopeful that we can get it out the next podcast, if not the next one, then definitely the one after that. So coming to you for Christmas.
Or shortly thereafter.
Yeah, in the meantime, exactly. It's heavy. It's really, really, really heavy. It's really, really hard. A lot of people are going to find it fairly disturbing. So if you find abductions of children and sexual violence against children particularly triggering for you, it might be a podcast that you just skip over.
Yeah. I might skip over it, but in any event, in the meantime, I'm going to continue to focus on fan requests, and I'll actually be able to name the fan that suggested the case outside of
this.
So
if you were the fan that suggested this case, please say hello in the comments so we can thank you properly.
Yes,
so,
that would be lovely.
But thank you anonymously until we know your name. So
sounds great. All right. So if you'd like to learn more about Victoria, take it away.
Books or readings or anything else, head to victorialaurie.com. If you liked our podcast, please hit the like button. Think about subscribing and telling all your friends.
Yes.
Tell your friends. Woo!
Great.
Until next time.
Yes. Thank you all for tuning in. Thank you for your support and your patience. We will get back on a more consistent schedule soon.
Well, we have been kind of the last two have been kind of, you know, boom, boom. Only a week apart.
Okay.
Nine days.
Yeah.
Take your kid.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, everyone. Have a great day.
Bye, Sandy. I love you.
Love you too.
Okay.